A beautifully rehabbed row home on a crumbling Camden block defines a paradox.
So this is the building that people get stressed out in.
Oh, wow.
So
what's going on that a safe space is making people feel less safe?
This place is overwhelming me. I got to get out of here.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health science and innovation.
I'm Tanya English.
I'm Alana Gordon.
I'm Zach Seward.
I'm Elizabeth Perez-Luna.
I'm Jeanette Woods.
And I'm Mike and Scott. The Pulse will sample junk food and dance with scientists if that's what it takes to understand the latest treatments and developments.
Energy right where you use it. Point of use energy generation.
You're really just a very specialized fish walking on very modified fins.
It's kind of like, how did they do that? How did they have that capability when we don't?
Anesthetics are really good at what they do.
It gives people pleasure. If someone's making money off of it, it must be bad.
I don't know. It's a mess. Right.
Could this be elevated potassium, but I'm afraid to say
it's wrong. To think like a
I'm literally holding in my hands a human heart.
On today's show, imagine not being able to smell a thing. No roses, no coffee, no burning toast, nothing. We'll hear about new research on treating the loss of smell. Also, navigating life with schizophrenia and some slippery science. But first, let's head back inside of this bright and beautiful row home on State Street in Camden. This is a great place to examine a big movement that could revolutionize public health and how social services are delivered.
So there's rooms upstairs, a couple of offices, but it's built to have community.
I'm with Father Jeff Puthoff, a sturdy Jesuit priest. He runs a program called HopeWorks that's been teaching struggling youth computer and life skills for over a decade. So some of the kids in the program move into the house here on State Street to get away from toxic family situations. And Puthoff thought providing them this great safe space would make their lives better. But it didn't really. They told him they felt really ill at ease in their new environment. And the computer training that the program provides, those results were mixed too. Puthoff and his staff would work hard to train a young person and to set them up with a job.
And then they oftentimes blow it up. So they're in a situation and they underperform, they get angry, they don't show up, they're not able to manage a schedule.
Puthoff's staff was getting frustrated and started to crack down.
Youth might show up late. And so people here started saying, well, if you're 3 times late, you can't come back for a month.
But this tough love wasn't working at all. Kids would just stop showing up. And that's when Puthoff discovered a whole world of research on something called trauma-informed care. Simply put, it poses a different question.
Not why did you do something? We're trying to think about what happened to that youth.
And he's not the only one asking that different question.
Moving from just asking what's wrong with you to really asking what happened to you.
This concept of really trying to understand behaviors rather than jumping in to fix them is really catching on among mental health providers in recent years. And they all use the same word.
Trauma.
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 Trauma-informed.
Injuries to the brain due to experience.
This is not PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, we're talking about here. PTSD is typically seen as a response to a specific traumatic event in the person's life. Trauma in this context is chronic stress and adversity that starts in childhood and changes people over time.
It changed the landscape because of the pervasiveness of the ACEs, the huge number of public
health. A lot of this thinking can be traced back to the so-called ACE study. It's a massive ongoing research project that ties adverse childhood experiences, ACE, to serious physical and mental health problems later in life.
The power of the ACE study is it's simple.
Speaking here is Robert Anda, one of the principal investigators for the study. It's a collaboration between the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and Kaiser Permanente's Health Appraisal Clinic in San Diego. For the initial study, Anda and others asked 17,000 middle-class people 10 questions about their childhoods. Had there been physical or sexual abuse, neglect? Were their parents divorced? Was there drug use in their home? And so on.
The voices of the 17,000 people in this study spoke, and it jumped right out. You don't have to be a genius to analyze this data and see what it shows.
The lifelong impact of having a high ACE score, meaning having experienced four or more different adversities, is devastating. The study found increased rates of cancer, heart disease, diabetes, obesity. And by the way, if you want to check your own ACE score, we've posted a link to the questionnaire on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. You answer 10 questions. Each time you answer yes, you get a point, and the total is your score. High ACE scores are also connected to serious mental health and social problems.
About 60 to 75% of substance dependence is directly correlated with early childhood adversity and stress.
Psychiatrist Stephen Berkowitz heads the Penn Center for Youth and Family Trauma Response and Recovery in Philly, where he says high rates of poverty typically mean high ACE scores. He says over time, people adapt to ongoing adversity, for example, to a lack of safety.
When you feel chronically endangered, one of the best ways to take care of that is to be the aggressor rather than the victim. And we see that in the city all the time.
In essence, trauma-informed care means don't jump in to fix a behavior. Look at the behavior as a clue, as something that tells a bigger story. At HopeWorks in Camden, I met Latifa Kersey, who seemed tense and very much on edge, ready to jump up and go. The young mom has lived in some of the city's most violent neighborhoods and has adapted accordingly when she walks around.
If I had my son, my boyfriend has to stay behind me and watch, because I'm watching in front. I can't see what's in back of me.
Do you ever relax?
No.
Now, think back to the house we visited at the beginning of the story. Bright, freshly renovated, and yet new residents typically can't stand it. Father Jeff Puthoff says when viewed through this lens of life experience, the get-me-out-of-here response suddenly makes sense.
They're very much ready to be attacked, and so their bodies are always having a high level of cortisol, and so they actually have a physiological response to moving into a safer place that's uncomfortable.
His staff now reviews these feelings with young people moving into the house and offers them coping strategies, such as listening to music or exercising. Across the river in Philadelphia, understanding this context of traumatic experience is also becoming a guiding principle in delivering services.
Just being aware that people come to us with those histories, that in and of itself opens up a whole different set of questions that we want to ask people.
Dr. Arthur Evans heads the city's Department of Behavioral Health Services, which has changed its approach to becoming trauma-informed.
So that we're not just looking at people's symptoms, but we're really trying to look at the underlying issues that led to those symptoms.
Evans says it's an ongoing process, one he likens to turning a gigantic ocean liner around. It means a lot of staff training, making sure the latest treatments are used in the field. They've made policy changes, for example, avoiding out-of-state foster placement for children, because that's a traumatic experience. They send teams into neighborhoods after violent incidents, and on and on.
A lot of times the child's behavior is just a marker of what's going on in terms of the home and the family and the community the child's growing up in.
The gospel of trauma-informed care is also resonating with pediatricians who are increasingly dealing with behavior and developmental issues in children. Pediatrician Andy Garner of Case Western Reserve University travels all over the country, urging his colleagues that a kid's relationship with their caretakers is as important a vital sign as the heart rate.
And so as a pediatrician, when you see a family, you see a mother or a father and the child, and it's clear that the relationship doesn't seem quite right, that they're not interacting in a helpful way, that they're stressed, that they're not in tune with each other, that you sense that the attachment isn't going very well, that's a huge risk factor and a red flag and something that we want to try and address.
How do you address these issues? In Philadelphia, pediatricians, mental health providers, and policymakers have formed an Adverse Childhood Experiences Task Force to discuss just that. Joel Fine of the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia is one of the chairs of this task force.
the city has truly become more ACEs aware, and all of the systems that we've interacted with, from police to behavioral health, have really started to carry the flag for this knowledge base and the activities that go along with it.
Fine says so far the task force has mostly been doing groundwork. The next step is to figure out what exactly can be done about all of this. And that's part of what's been frustrating UPenn psychiatrist Stephen Berkowitz. A lot of buzz, not enough action.
There's words, and there are people doing some good work, but there's no policy. And this is the kind of huge issue that requires real policy change.
He says not enough is done on a national level to prevent adverse childhood experiences from happening in the first place. He would like to see political action, support for struggling families, parenting classes, education, and on and on. He says prevention has been key in making a dent in other major public health problems.
The first thing that had an impact on mortality rates due to cancer was smoking prevention and cessation. And I think that it absolutely mimics what I'm talking about in terms of the effects of traumatic experience and stress in children.
But he knows it's not going to happen anytime soon.
That's a lifetime's work. That's not, you know, something that's going to happen in a couple years or even a decade. It's going to take much longer.
While big changes may take years to happen, Berkowitz says there's one thing to keep in mind. There is something that seems to protect children from the lifelong impact of childhood adversity.
There has been an adult in your life who has paid attention and cared for you. That seems to be the most resilient promoting factor.
And that adult could be anybody, a teacher, a friend, a neighbor, or you. The piece of music we're listening to right now was written by Philly musician Brooke Blair, but check this one out. This is music from Pulse engineer Charlie Kyer, music that comes right from his skin. Charlie created, or should we say transmitted, this piece during an event at Penn's Institute of Contemporary Art. Zach Seward has the details.
Check 1, 2, 1, 2.
Charlie's holding a gray box about the size of a brick. He's with Joe Patitucci, a co-founder of Data Garden, which is a Philly record label and arts organization that lives right at the corner of music and science.
What this does is it actually translates biorhythms, like from plants or from humans, into data that can be played with a synthesizer or through a computer.
What that means is that this music is a digital translation of the electrical currents always pulsing through Charlie's palms. Using the sensors you'd see on a lie detector, Data Garden can measure changes in what's called skin conductance and have each frequency play a corresponding sound.
A plant or a human can play, you know, any note on a scale that we choose to allow it to.
Patitucci says this gizmo is a prototype of something Data Garden wants to mass produce called a MIDI sprout. He says a crowdfunding campaign is coming next month in a bid to get more people exposed to playing around with wonky ways of making, microgenre alert, biofeedback music.
It's not about ego. It's kind of more about kind of an exploration of your own body or different forces in the universe.
This music is coming from another interactive installation at the ICA event. Here's Charlie with an explanation.
So what you can't see right now is Joe sitting at a table, grabbing two apples, and there are wires hooked up to the table that go underneath and to his chair, and he's vibrating and hearing things through the headphones.
Those vibrations are coming from a mini subwoofer.
It's interesting because both the kind of analog and the digital here play an equally important role.
That's ICA curator Grace Ambrose. The museum is in its 50th anniversary season, and the Data Garden Micro Exhibition is one of about 50 it's putting on this year. Ambrose says the cool thing about this one was the tangible interplay of the human and the non-human, electrical currents from the body becoming blips and beats. A packed house of about 300 showed up to the event. It also doubled as a record release party for musician Greg Fox. Fox worked with a jazz drummer and healer who developed another set of technologies that transform human biorhythms into the language of electronic instruments, or MIDI.
We made sort of high-quality recordings of my heartbeat, my resting heartbeat, and then used software that he developed with another person to translate that information into a MIDI score, like a very rich MIDI score, and bringing all the sub-frequencies up out of it so that the pitch and the melody of the heartbeat can be heard.
Tell me when you're ready. For The Pulse, I'm Zach Seward.
And I'm Charlie Kyer.
Okay, that was cool.
Can't get enough of that biorhythmic music you're hearing right now? Head to our website, whyy.org/The Pulse. Coming up, think of all of the great things you smell in a single day.
Preserved lemon and cumin and coriander and crushed red peppers.
But sometimes you don't know what you got till it's gone.
The same neutral, blank, indescribable nothing.
The loss of smell and what scientists are learning about it. That's next on The Pulse.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca's patient assistance programs help qualified patients access the AstraZeneca medicines they need while providing them with information that can help them stay healthy. In 2013, AstraZeneca served more than 567,000 patients through its prescription savings programs, including AZ and Me and the MedImmune Assistance Program. Learn more at azandme.com and myaccess360.com.
Supporting WHYY, the Kimmel Center, presenting Newport Jazz Festival, now 60, Sunday, March 9th at the Merriam Theater. Founded in 1964 and hailed as the grandfather of jazz festivals, Newport celebrates its first six decades with a concert tour spanning musical styles from Louis, Duke, and Miles to Latin, Brazilian, and fusion. Saxophonist Anat Cohen leads a multi-generational ensemble that includes guitarist Mark Whitfield and trumpeter Randy Brecker. Tickets at KimmelCenter.org.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse. Independence Blue Cross is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents will be available to help clear up confusion, answer questions, and even help you decide on a policy. IBC is dedicated to helping you make the best decision with your health insurance. The Independence Express truck is visiting neighborhoods now. More information online at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Researchers in Philadelphia are looking for new ways to help people who've lost their sense of smell. That news in a moment, but first, let's revisit a story from reporter Carolyn Beeler. In 2012, Carolyn spent a day with a woman living in a world without smell.
For most people, Reading Terminal Market is a smorgasbord of scents. Frying cheesesteaks, fish,
salmon, bronzino, and bluefish,
and freshly ground coffee. But for Andy Hockman, all of it, even the lilac and eucalyptus at the flower stall, smells the same.
I smell nothing. Air. The same smell I would smell in front of the coffee place, in front of a tray of freshly baked chocolate chip cookies, the same neutral, blank, indescribable nothing.
Hockman is a freelance writer and teacher who lives in Mount Airy. She lost her sense of smell about 6 years ago while on a family vacation in Mexico.
I was surrounded by all kinds of smells, like the little store that sold Mexican vanilla and coffee. I couldn't smell any of it.
The winter before, Hockman had had a series of bad colds and likely a sinus infection. Later, she was diagnosed with nasal polyps, inflammations in the nasal cavity. Her sense of smell came back for a few weeks 2 years ago when a doctor put her on oral steroids.
What was amazing about that was that each thing I could smell came trailing a whole storehouse of memories that were connected with it. So I smelled these pizzas in the back of my car, and I remembered being in college working at the newspaper and having a stack of really greasy pizzas delivered every night at 9.
But the drugs were only a temporary fix. When she stopped taking them, she quickly lost her sense of smell once again.
Many, many times during a typical week, someone, even the people in my family who've known that I've had no sense of smell for years, will say, "Oh, smell this," or "That smells so good," or "I don't think this yogurt is good anymore. Here, give it a smell." And I can't. That was a surprise to me, how much we talk about and refer to smell as a common or even a unifying experience.
Because the sense of taste is really so much about smell, the self-described foodie says she now tastes in black and white instead of Technicolor. She hopes one day she'll be able to smell the challah she bakes from an old family recipe each Friday.
I braid it, I brush it with egg, I sprinkle it with poppy seeds, I shove it into the oven, and then I set the timer to know when it's ready. The fact that I can't smell it baking, that's something I miss the most.
And we checked in with Andy Hockman. She went back to her ear, nose, and throat doctor about a year after this story aired originally. She just wanted to know if the doctor could maybe try one more time to restore her sense of smell. Several previous attempts using steroids had failed, but this time...
Once again, a 10-day course of steroids, followed by a nightly nasal rinse containing a little packet of saline and pH-adjusted powder, and then a little liquid ampoule of an asthma medicine called budesonide that I squirt into the nasal rinse, squirt it up one nostril, it drips down the other, do the same thing in reverse. It's a little revolting, but I got used to it.
Hockman uses the drops every night, and voila, she can smell
everything. Yesterday, I was trying a new recipe out of beautiful new cookbook called Jerusalem. The first step of this fairly complicated recipe involved making your own pickled lemons. I had to slice lemons very thin and then macerate them in a bowl with red chili pepper and cumin, coriander, lemon juice, olive oil, and paprika. And it smelled like the way I imagine a Middle Eastern fruit market might smell. After I squashed the lemons with all these spices, the instruction was to put a cover on the bowl and set it aside for a couple of hours. And I kept coming into the kitchen and lifting the cover off the bowl just to smell it, just because I could.
Andy Hockman isn't sure why she lost her sense of smell in the first place. Researchers say sometimes it's sinus troubles, sometimes head trauma, or a bad case of the flu. Medicine can help, sometimes, but scientists are now looking for a new way to fix this problem by duplicating the body's ability to build and repair nasal tissue, Tanya English reports.
It's a coin flip, really. In about 50% of cases, the sense of smell never comes back. And that loss is often underrated when it comes to health and well-being.
Well, smell is maybe the most primitive of senses. And it's the major source of information for most species on the planet.
Gary Beecham directs Philadelphia's Monell Chemical Senses Center.
We study smell and taste.
Humans are constantly sniffing out danger, spoiled food in the refrigerator, a gas leak, even our own body odor. Still, Beecham says, smell is the sense we take for granted. It's part of an early warning system that inextricably links smell and taste. To demonstrate, Beecham pours out a cup of jelly beans. For this experiment, the gourmet kind are best.
Coffee.
Licorice, watermelon.
And here we've got banana.
Without looking, he chooses two candies.
Basically, what we do is we take two jelly beans that are two different flavors, then put them in your hand, randomly move them around so you don't know which is which. You hold your nose very tightly. So then take one of the jelly beans, put it in your mouth, chew it up.
Then Beecham takes a guess.
The only thing I get in terms of flavor is sweet. So then all I have to do is let go of my nose, and boom, there it is.
Licorice. On its own, the tongue perceives salty or bitter or sour, but without smell, the subtleties of anise or fennel are missing. When people go to the doctor complaining about smell loss, though, they don't get much sympathy.
Their primary physician often has no idea what to say or what to do. They consider it sort of like losing a toenail or something like that.
Anosmia is the medical term for an inability to perceive odor. But when the nose is working properly, neurons are nerve cells in the nasal tissue, grab odor molecules from the air, then transmit that signal.
And then the brain registers, oh, this is the wonderful smell of lilacs.
Edmund Perbitkin is an ear, nose, and throat specialist at Jefferson University Hospital. To explain what can go wrong, Perbitkin says imagine yourself with a respiratory infection. When you're sniffling and congested, it means a cold virus has taken up residence in the lining of your nose.
Well, those neurons are connected up to the brain. And your body says, I've got this horrible virus. I better just cut this bridge.
Better to sacrifice the sense of smell than to risk brain inflammation that can lead to encephalitis or meningitis.
It's a defense mechanism. It lets the neuron die.
Nerve cells in the nose can recover, but in many cases, they don't. Antibiotics or steroid medications sometimes help. But researchers at Jefferson and Mornell are looking for a new way to treat smell loss. Their big idea is to take special cells from the inside of the nose, they're called stem cells, and then use them to cure smell disorders. Stem cells are special because they have the potential to become other cell types. Perbitkin, who's a gardener, explains it this way. In the plant world, if you plant basil, you get basil. But
the amazing thing about these types of cells is, you know what? We can take this seed and maybe we can decide after we've planted it, or depending upon where we've planted it, whether it grows into tomato or basil.
The scientists want to engineer stem cells in the lab to become functioning nerve cells that control smell. The first step is a quick office procedure to collect nasal tissue from healthy volunteers.
And with a very, very small forceps, about the size of a pencil tip, we can basically take the cells that we need to do research.
Next, that nasal tissue gets shipped across town to Mornell. There, researcher Mrijala Vinjamuri is currently working with cells from mice, but she starts work on human cells in just a few weeks. Vinjamuri turns a few knobs to focus her microscope, then peers down to check the next batch of harvested tissue.
You should be able to see small dots everywhere, and those are your different cells.
The sample includes some neurons, probably a few stem cells, and lots of cells that give nasal tissue its structure. But it's not clear which cells are which. That's the work ahead, to isolate stem cells and then nudge them to become odor-detecting neurons.
Can we transplant them back into humans who have this issue, and can these stem cells still function properly?
That goal is complex enough and years away. But Vinjamuri says there's an even bigger obstacle ahead. Neurons in the nose are coded for, only lit up by certain smells.
Each neuron can sort of detect a specific odor. For instance, if you have an odor for strawberries or something, or banana, for instance, only a certain subset of neurons can smell that.
Getting a nose to detect an odor, that's just one step. Success is making sure the lab-engineered replacement cells send the right signal back to the brain. For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
If you want to conduct your own smell test using jelly beans, check out our video demonstration at whyy.org/thepulse. So, on my way to work the other day, it seemed like the world had totally lost its grip, and I mean that literally. It had snowed a lot in the preceding days, but the sun was finally out, the temperatures were warming up, the snow was melting, so I thought traction should improve. But that was not so at all. Cars were fishtailing all over the streets, the bus was 40 minutes late, people were slipping and falling. What was going on there? We asked Pulse contributor and med student Avir Mitra to get to the bottom of this, and he decided to start at a counterintuitive location.
Today I'm at the Piazza in Northern Liberties, where they set up an ice skating rink for the winter. But there's something different about the ice.
It's artificial ice.
That's right. Everyone's ice skating using regular ice skates, but there's no ice. The rink isn't frozen, it doesn't melt, but somehow people are slipping and sliding on it. Now, I'm not a professional figure skater, but this is confusing. So here I am with the guy who made the rink.
My name is Stephen Murphy. I'm from Boston, Massachusetts. I work for a company called Artificial Ice Events.
So how do you build an artificial ice skating rink? What's the process?
I can show you how it's put together if you want.
Yeah, sounds cool. Stephen takes me to a separate room where he has some spare parts of the rink lying around.
It's like putting a piece of puzzle together. It comes in 4x8 panels.
What are these panels made out of? It's
a plastic polymer material. The best thing I can compare it to would be like a cutting board that you have in your kitchen.
He throws the panels on the floor and starts hammering them into place. Okay, so I'm standing on this synthetic surface, but actually it's not really slippery at all.
Without solution, it isn't slippery the slightest bit. It's called propylene glycol.
Propylene glycol is acting as a lubricant, so when Steven sprays it on a smooth, flat surface, you can glide across that surface without much friction. What makes propylene glycol especially useful compared to other lubricants, such as engine oil, is that it is uniquely compatible with our biology. In other words, it's not toxic.
It doesn't irritate the skin in any way. If you ingest it, it's not an issue. It's not going to cause you to vomit or feel nauseous or anything. It's not going to irritate your skin, your eyes, anything.
In fact, propylene glycol is used as a non-active ingredient in all sorts of products. You can find it in soaps, shampoos, toothpaste, cough syrup, cookies, beer, the list goes on. It's even used in e-cigarettes.
So I pump up the sprayer, so it builds pressure inside, and then I just go around the panels, and I spray a layer on it. And it doesn't need to be completely covered. When your skate gets in the solution, it just glides right through.
So it turns out the science of artificial ice isn't all that complicated. Throw some lubricant on a flat surface and you can skate. Real ice skating, on the other hand, is actually more interesting. I spoke with Songgang Chu, a professor of mechanical engineering at Temple University. As Dr. Chu explained it to me, ice isn't actually slippery. It's actually a very tiny layer of water on top of the ice that we're slipping on.
So the top surface of ice is the mixture of ice and water. That makes surface slippery. So for example, I used to live in Minnesota, and driving over there sometimes was hot, but most time was okay because the temperature over there was extremely low, right? And so its ice is extremely rigid. In that case, you will find out it's not too bad. The worst case is that when temperature gets about right, say just under the freezing temperature, so the ice is not pure ice, it has both ice and water on the surface. That makes driving so hot.
So exactly what we've been dealing with in our neck of the woods for the past month, it feels like.
Right.
With ice and water, nature has created a perfect scenario for skating. Ice is a smooth surface that constantly provides its own lubricant. And when your skates scratch into the surface, the water can freeze and make the surface smooth again. So despite all our scientific progress, it seems we still can't beat simple water. But there are some benefits to artificial ice.
It's a 10% drag on your skate. I know a lot of NHL goaltenders, they actually train on this stuff. And a lot of Olympic speed skaters train on it because of that 10% drag.
So it's like running with weights or something.
Exactly.
I caught up with a family on the rink.
Rachel.
Hey, John Davidson.
And Emma.
Where are you guys from?
West Deptford.
All right, so how is it? I see you guys kind of slipping around on these ice skates.
Yeah, it's pretty difficult. It's not real ice, so it's very strange.
Are you normally really good with real ice?
Or? No, I'm horrible with any ice, but this is just even more difficult.
What do you think?
After a little bit of time moving around, and start to get a little bit more used to it. It's definitely completely, it's different. It's very different. Hey, Emma, say hi real quick.
Hi.
Are you enjoying yourself?
Yeah.
What do you think of this ground right here?
To pretend.
It's pretend ice.
Even she knows. Smart.
For The Pulse, I'm Avir Mitra. Wake up, wake up, crowded corners, and I think it's time to drink, don't you think? People fall as they get out their cars. In Philadelphia, that's how we do. In Philadelphia.
I have a question for you.
Guess what?
What?
chicken butt.
Okay, our next story really is about chicken butts, but there's some serious science attached to this. Joining us now is regular Pulse contributor Dr. Bethany Brookshire. She's a science writer and educator for Science News and also writes for Eureka Lab. She blogs under the name SciCurious. Bethany has a knack for finding the strangest science experiments and studies under the sun, and she shares them with us. Hi, Bethany.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure. So, this chicken butt thing, what is this all about?
Well, I actually found the video just going around the internet, and it's this hilarious looping YouTube video of this chicken walking. First, you see a normal chicken walking, and it says control. And then you see experimental chicken. And the experimental chicken is walking with what looks like a toilet plunger attached to its butt.
Okay.
I found that actually this is a paper by Grossi et al. It's a group that was based in Chile. And they were actually looking at the biomechanics of how chickens and how dinosaurs may have walked. As we all know, birds nowadays are evolutionarily related to dinosaurs. And birds don't really have big, long tails like dinosaurs. Dinosaurs had these big, long, muscular tails. How would having something so big and weighty on the end change the way that an animal walks and stands? So to figure this out, Grossi et al. Actually attached tails to chickens.
Oh, so that's the toilet plunger looking thing?
Yes, it's actually attached via a Velcro jacket, which they informed me were not very sexy. And they put these on the chickens actually from the time that they were 3 days old. And they checked to see how this changed the way chickens stand and walk.
And what did they find?
They found that the tail, the weight of the tail, actually kind of shifts the chicken backward a little. It kind of makes them stand up more. And this means that when they walk, they actually move more, if anything, more like humans. They actually move more from the hip. So their thighs move more. And this confirmed a lot about what scientists have hypothesized about the way that many theropod dinosaurs may have moved.
So by doing all this, the ultimate goal was to learn something about how dinosaurs walked.
That is the ultimate goal. And we have a lot of computer models that can kind of, you know, look at this and take it into account. But a computer model is only as good as the data you put into it. So you have to get that data, which means that you need to put a wooden tail on a chicken's butt.
Dr. Bethany Brookshire is a science writer and educator for Science News, and she blogs under the name SciCurious. Coming up on The Pulse, what happens when things stop making sense?
At one point, I was actually declared to be insane, an insane person, and committed, and told I'd spend the rest of my life in the hospital. But I got out.
Living, working, making a difference with schizophrenia. That's next here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents can help explain the changes and prepare you for what's ahead. More at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca is dedicated to improving health in communities across the Philadelphia region. On Twitter at AstraZeneca US or on Facebook at AstraZeneca US Community Connections.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
Colm Toybean's novel, The Testament of Mary, imagines Mary's life 20 years after her son's crucifixion. She struggles to understand why Jesus' followers, men she considers misfits, believe he was the Son of God. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Colm Toybean. His novel is now out in paperback. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Welcome. Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. Imagine feeling like you're the only one who can see clearly, who knows what's really happening. In our series, The Spark, people in the field of health and science describe what sparked their passion for their careers. And this time we hear from Dr. Frederick Fries. Fries was in his 20s when he experienced a major psychotic break, which marked the onset of schizophrenia. Despite his illness, and partly because of his experiences, he's had a long and successful career in mental health services.
At one point, I was actually declared to be insane, an insane person, and committed, and told I'd spend the rest of my life in the hospital. But I got out. There were no overt symptoms until I came down with a disorder. I mean, I'd been selected for a national scholarship by the Navy and then selected again to go in the Marine Corps. I'd served 4 years, just been promoted to captain. When I developed this delusional system concerning the Vietnam War. I mean, here I was working 24/7 guarding these atomic weapons, and then they locked me away and called me crazy. I was absolutely sure they were making a mistake. In my mind, and that's the way it works with schizophrenia, delusions, when you have this, you can't tell yourself that there's really something wrong with you. So I spent quite some time thinking that really there's nothing wrong with me. But after a number of hospitalizations, particularly when I was put away as insane, I thought, yeah, it's probably, maybe there's something wrong here. Not with me, but something wrong somewhere. The big thing that I feel is it's important for me to interact with the professional communities, the psychiatrists, the psychologists, the research communities, the Veterans Administration, and advocacy groups such as NAMI and the Mental Health Association, et cetera, and be a living example. I can function even though I have this disorder. And there are an awful lot of people like me. Most of them will not be open about having had these psychotic breaks. I'm not over it. I still have episodes, and the mind works funny ways, but I'm able to catch it with the medication and that sort of thing. 50 years ago, the answer to somebody being seriously mentally ill was to put them away forever, essentially. Now, 95 of those of us who were or would have been in those old state hospitals are out. Now, not all of us are doing as well as myself or some others. I mean, there are too many homeless in the streets or in jail. But I personally feel that nobody, absolutely nobody, should be given forced treatment unless they need it. But the fact of the matter is, at times, we, including myself, have needed and will need some kind of coerced, leveraged treatment to keep you from getting off the streets. So over and over again, research is showing us that people with these conditions who are receiving outpatient treatment are far less likely to be arrested than those who aren't getting the treatment, which are getting better. Now, in the old days, I didn't want to be lobotomized. I didn't want forced electroshock therapy and the terrible things that were done in the early 20th century. But for the most part, that's behind us. Starting in 2000 or so, we began to get laws trained better, and we began to get the police trained. 40 hours of training, how to interact with a person who is seriously mentally ill, and it changed their lives. When we passed those laws to get all the people out of the state hospital, nobody told the policemen they were going to be the new mental health workers. It puts joy in my heart to see younger folks who have been through what I've been through coming out and deciding to join in the fight.
Dr. Frederick Fries is a psychologist and retired Marine Corps captain. He is currently on the board of scientific advisors for Schizophrenia Bulletin. Elizabeth Perez Luna produced this piece. Treatments and approaches to schizophrenia have changed a lot since Fries experienced his first major psychotic break. And joining us now to discuss the latest research is Dr. Kim Muser. He is a clinical psychologist and executive director of the Center for Psychiatric Rehabilitation at Boston University. Thank you so much for joining us.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
What are some of the new approaches to dealing with and treating schizophrenia?
Well, over the past 30-plus years, there's been a great movement towards community-based services. And many of those services involve providing people with the practical assistance and training and skills and coping strategies to live rewarding lives on their own. Before this, many people spent much of their lives in psychiatric hospitals. Now, for example, there's an emphasis on helping people live as independently as possible in the community, helping people seek and obtain jobs through programs such as supported employment that focus on helping people get competitive jobs in integrated community settings. Probably the greatest shift in the field has been towards looking at the lives that people are capable of living and the concept of recovery, people living worthwhile and rewarding lives, despite the fact that they may experience symptoms.
What are the major barriers that remain? We hear a lot about homeless people, people in prisons, and the rates of schizophrenia among those people are high.
You're absolutely right. One barrier certainly that remains is, despite the fact that the field of psychiatric rehabilitation and pharmacological treatments and other areas have made tremendous strides in recent decades, most of the most effective services are not available to people in their community settings.
What do we know about outcomes for people who are living with schizophrenia? It's often viewed as perhaps the most devastating mental illness.
It's true that for many people, they may continue to have symptoms throughout much of their lives. However, we also know that significant numbers of people do recover from schizophrenia, both symptomatically and functionally. And then we also know that not everybody who experiences a psychotic episode goes on to experience a long-term course of schizophrenia.
What's the importance of early intervention?
Well, one of the most important things about early intervention has to do with the fact that the longer one waits to intervene after a person has developed psychotic symptoms, the more severe the symptoms tend to get, and the more impaired the functioning becomes, and the more difficult it is to help the person get on with their lives. Often when people have not been able to access effective treatment during the early stages of the illness, they may withdraw. Family members may withdraw out of frustration. And what happens is that ineffective coping strategies get put in place, and sometimes people end up turning to substance use and problems such as that, which make it all the more difficult to help stabilize the person's symptoms and to get them moving forward in their life paths again.
Do we as a society understand schizophrenia better than we used to?
I believe we do understand it better. I believe that there has been a lot of efforts to correct public misconceptions. There's certainly been a movement to have people who have experienced the disorder speak publicly about their experiences. For example, the experiences of the Nobel Prize winner John Nash in the movie A Beautiful Mind really brought home, I believe, a lot of accurate information to the American public about the nature of schizophrenia, that this is not a disorder in terms of a split personality, that people are not violent, and that the psychotic symptoms that people often experience are as real to the person experiencing them as reality is to you and I and in our experience of it.
Kim Muser is a clinical psychologist and executive director of the Center for Psychiatric Rehabilitation at Boston University. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, too.
My name is John Nash. I'm being held against my will. Somebody call the Department of Defense.
Have you ever read a novel or watched a movie and then replayed the story in your head just for fun? Sure you have. People with autism will sometimes replay stories in their heads over and over and over, warping and morphing them into something new. Reporter Peter Crimmins went to Norristown, Pennsylvania, where a theater company is teaching adults with autism to write those stories down and to turn them into plays.
A handful of actors from Theater Horizon in Norristown asked playwright Stephen Solomon how they should deliver their lines, and this is how he directed them. Solomon is on the autism spectrum, and he has a hard time verbalizing, but he knows how to get his point across. He is asking his actors for a high-energy, frantic delivery.
I'm about to say,
really funny lines.
Sometimes the vocalizations are not typical to my ears or yours, the intonation or sometimes the repetition of words.
That is Tasha Milkman. She's an actor and teacher with Philadelphia Young Playwrights.
It's kind of amazing sometimes to when you think someone's not in tune to what the conversation is in the group, and then all of a sudden you realize they absolutely are. They're just expressing that in a different way.
In this six-week workshop, the teaching artists with Philadelphia Young Playwrights are helping seven students, all adults with autism, write short one-act plays. And it isn't easy. Most of the students in this class have vast, sprawling stories in their heads. Because of their condition, they tend to replay those stories over and over and over, constantly reviewing, but never really getting it down. By making them write a short scene with a beginning, middle, and end, which is two or three characters, Milkman says they get knocked off that repetitive treadmill and really get into some creative thinking.
Some of the students are very, very excited about a specific story or one movie that they've seen or a genre of TV show or something like that. And I think that some of them are struggling to find their own story in the inundation they have with other people's stories.
Lena Kallner is one of those students. She's writing a short play, but really, it's an excerpt of a much larger epic story she's been building in her head for years.
It's really a transcript of a TV show, honestly, called Real Time with Darby Green. Real Time is spelled with two E's. Essentially a parody of entertainment reporting.
Kallner, who's 20, has autism, and she watches a lot of TV. A lot of TV. She has internalized the characters and plots from a huge number of TV shows, and she uses them for material for her own story about this entertainment news program, which is really a bunch of made-up TV shows nested inside this made-up TV show.
I also create a fake fan following for a fake TV show in the story. Completely fake actors playing fake characters in the story. The best way to describe it is Homeland meets Game of Thrones. It's a story about how they use psychics to combat terrorism.
Kallner talks fast, and she thinks fast. Sometimes it can be hard to follow her. Okay. But that's the point, says Theater Horizon Artistic Director Aaron Riley.
Their take on the world is so innovative and incredibly personal and unique to them. I learn something new about this world every time I'm in this class with these students.
The plays written by students with autism are performed once by professional actors at the end of each workshop. I'm Peter Crimmins for The Pulse.
And we have a video of the playwright workshop. Go to our website at whyy.org/thepulse. And that's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Zach Seward, and Alana Gordon. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Joel Patterson our assistant producer, Megan Pinto the executive producer, Chris Cetullo is vice president of news, and Christine Dempsey our chief content officer. If you missed some of this show or any of our previous shows, go and subscribe to our podcast at whyy.org/thepulse. And we'd really like to hear from you. Email us with your feedback at thepulse@whyy.org. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening. The Children's Cry.